why we're seeing a lot of coverage of Iran and not much coverage of the U.S.
What do you think is most interesting coming out of this new congressional debate?
Boy, not much.
You really think that that it's pretty much a done deal, that it will go through more or less as it's being proposed?
Yes, I do.
You've written in recent months about the White House's push for this.
Yes, and there is support. There is widespread support on the Hill for U.S. nuclear weapons, and especially in the face of, in the wake of Putin's actions in Crimea, there is, politically, is very, very difficult to get any support for, you know, modest reductions, modest changes to what the Obama administration is proposing.
That's shocking that a dispute over Ukraine and Crimea would lead to a policy that seems to suggest that nuclear weapons use is more likely than it was a few months ago.
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting. The U.S. and Russia, you know, have several arms agreements about their nuclear weapons that involves monitoring and dismantlement. And there are members of Congress who are arguing that we should pull out of, you know, basically we should stop those activities, which is just the opposite of what we should be doing. So it's very, it is really shocking. And there are people who have suggested we should introduce tactical nuclear weapons into more countries in Europe. Right now, the U.S. Deploys these shorter range nuclear weapons in 5 countries in Europe. And people have suggested they need to add them to other countries, which, again, it's just the opposite of what you want to do. The last thing you want is to turn this crisis in Ukraine into a nuclear crisis.
How do you think the press does generally in covering these nuclear appropriations?
I think it's a shame because it's a really important story. And I think it's not just a question of, you know, the latest budget numbers, but really, why do we have these weapons still in these large numbers? What is it that we're planning to do with the weapons? There's a whole range of questions that the media should be asking and probing. And, you know, this is really fundamental to a democracy, is the media needs to provide the information that the public should have to make sound decisions. And the public is not engaged.
We've been speaking with Elizabeth Gronlund, the co-director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Global Security Program. You can read some of her writing at the UCS website at ucsusa.org. Thanks again for joining us on Counterspin today, Elizabeth Gronlund.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining KBOO Portland for Counterspin. Coming up next is Bread and Roses with your host, Delphine Crescenzo. So keep it locked right here. 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. Before we get started tonight, I want to let you know that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dharma Portland Association. Presenting spiritual teacher Shur Tahata speaking on A Path to Peace, Restoring Harmony in These Times of Change, May 30th and 31st at the Unity World Healing Center. Program includes music, meditation, spiritual discourse, and personal blessing. Information and registration at pathofdharma.org. KBOO.org. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirect.com. Again, welcome to all of you. To Bread and Roses. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. We offer a forum to those working for social justice and equity globally and locally, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All of this, and we have fun. Women have had this forum on KBOO since 1978. That's 35 years. We always welcome new collective members, so if you would like to host, produce, or engineer with us, contact Ani Haynes, KBOO's volunteer manager at volunteer@kboo.fm. You can also, kboo.org. You can also find Bread and Roses on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to past shows, share comments, or show ideas. And you can also find us on Facebook at KBOO Bread and Roses. Tonight, we talk about issues of domestic violence and how they are impacting the Portland Latino community. I have the pleasure to welcome in the studio Kat Kelly and Shella Ramirez from Catholic Charities Hispanic program, Proyecto Unica. Project Unica has a goal to provide support, advocacy, and opportunity for self-empowerment, enabling survivors to exercise free and informed life choices. Kat Kelly is the program manager for Project Unica. She is originally from rural Colorado and has lived in Oregon for 14 years. She's been a social worker for 11 years and has been working with the Latino community for the last 5 years. Kat has a particular passion for working with survivors of domestic and sexual violence, as many, many of the people she loves are survivors. Shella Ramirez is the Crisis Line Coordinator and Lead Domestic Violence Advocate for Project Unica. Shella was born in Havana, Cuba, and came to the United States during the Cuban Exodus of 1994, escaping from the dictatorship. She spent 42 hours in a raft and was sent to Guantanamo Bay after being detained by the U.S. Navy, where she spent 8 months. She arrived in the U.S. in April of 1995 and has been there ever since. She's moved in and out of Oregon 3 times, but no one has trees like Oregon, and they come back and they call her name. Shella has always wanted to use her passion for social work to help survivors like herself. She prioritizes working with survivors with high barriers such as language, immigration status, poverty, etc. She has 3 daughters, 18-year-old twins, and a 14-year-old, and Shella is currently writing her memoirs. Welcome, both of you, to Bread and Roses.
Thank you.
Shella, we'll have to have you back when your memoirs are been written. Let's start by talking a little bit about the Hispanic population who lives here in Portland and the Portland area, and who are the individuals and the families that you serve at Project Unica. Kat?
Well, I can speak to that a little. The Portland Latino community has been growing exponentially for the last 10 years. I'm sure most folks are aware of that. And We work with the majority of the folks that we work with are from Mexico, but we work with folks from all over the Americas. We have 8 countries represented inside of our staff, in fact, so that we can reflect the diversity inside of the Latino community. Mm-hmm. The Latino community is extremely diverse. We have folks from a number of racial, ethnic, class backgrounds, different areas, rural, urban, those kinds of things, different language backgrounds. It's just intensely diverse, which I think is something that folks often aren't aware of. It's not, you have folks coming from different countries and different parts of the continents who are then lumped into one group here when they move to the United States, Latino, and that's not necessarily the best reflection of the complex identities that are inside of that group.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a little bit about some of the challenges that families in domestic violence situation encounter, and how there are added challenges for the Latino families that you are serving.
The Latino community faces really unique challenges when it comes to dealing with issues of domestic violence and sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Of course, one of the first barriers that folks think of is the language barrier that mm-hmm. Often affects the way that folks are able to access or maintain engagement inside of services. But there's huge cultural issues that come up as well inside of the Latino community when searching for services that aren't necessarily met by mainstream agencies. Mm-hmm. That can include, you know, knowing how to work with extended family groups and respecting how families support and work with each other. It includes being knowledgeable about some of the barriers that go along with being undocumented, for example, not having mm-hmm. access to a driver's license or having to constantly worry about deportation. And so having fear of having to rely on police or other institutions who you don't feel like are necessarily trying to keep your family safe.
Shella's a little nervous. I was wondering if you could, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, just already when you are in a domestic violence situation, what does that feel? What's it like?
Well, it feels terrible. I think it's the most awful experience that a human being can go through. Mm-hmm. And it feels bad. And it's very hard to overcome mm-hmm. The trauma that it's caused by the abuse. But
yes, and here on Bread and Roses, we've had several conversations about you know, being a victim of domestic violence and some of the challenges. We've addressed some of the myth that exists out there of, why don't you just leave? Why don't you just, you know, move on? You understand this is not right for you. But as you shared, Kat, there's, you know, language barriers, and there are immigration status also sometime that add up to all of this and really create even more barriers. And so your program is really meant to help alleviate some of those issues. And so if you could talk a little bit about the philosophy and the overall mission of Project Unica, and first of all, how long has the project been around, and how was this all created?
I can talk a little to that. So Project Unica is part of El Programa Hispano. And El Programa Hispano is the Latino Services Division of Catholic Charities of mm-hmm. Oregon. El Programa Hispano has been around since 1982. And Proyecto Unica came about in 1992. And it came very much so out of need from the community. Mm-hmm. El Programa Hispano was seen as a community staple, as a community institution. It's very well trusted by the Latino community because it was created by and for the Latino community. So in the office that we used to have in Gresham, we still have an office there, but now it's much bigger. The office there in Gresham, families who were fleeing domestic violence would go to El Programa Hispano because they knew that was a place to go. That was a place where they felt safe and where they trusted the workers and those things. So from that need, Proyecto Unica came out of that with a need to have really deliberate interventions with a really strong infrastructure and network to meet the needs of survivors and their families. And we provided, you know, those kinds of interventions until 2005 when we launched the crisis line, Línea Única. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Shayla is the crisis line coordinator mm-hmm. of that. And Línea Única is really the core of our work. It's our most important aspect. Everything we do is important, but that's where the community is really able to access us. Mm-hmm. And through the line, maybe Shayla can speak a little bit about those services in particular and what mm-hmm. we do when someone calls us mm-hmm. who's in crisis.
Go ahead.
No.
No, you go.
Okay. So what I was going to say is talk a little bit about the crisis line.
Yes.
That Única Crisis Line has been serving the Latino community, I believe, for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the work that we do, it's amazing. I have to say that. And the calls that we receive are very intense. Pretty much, I will say that 90% of the calls that we get are crisis calls, and the rest, the other 10% can be like information and referral, folks trying to access housing resources and utility resources, mm-hmm. and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So one other thing about the crisis line is that it's the first crisis line in Spanish in Multnomah County.
It is, and it's actually the only Spanish cultural specific crisis line in Oregon, 24/7. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. It's pretty incredible.
It is, so
would you tell us what you say to someone who is in a crisis and calling? Are you able to direct these people to services? Are you able to help alleviate some of the fear, some of the anxiety?
When we get a crisis call, one of the first things that we ask is, are you safe right now? Can mm-hmm. you talk right now? Mm-hmm. Is it safe to have a conversation with us?
Mm-hmm.
If they say yes, because the abuser is not there, then we can continue. If we got any situation that, is not safe for the person, we encourage them to call 911, which is,
which would be one of the unfortunately, you don't have people that you can send
right
to help people directly.
Yeah. But we can definitely safety plan with them, mm-hmm. and if the survivor needs a safe place to go, mm-hmm. we can of course assist with that,
mm-hmm.
and we always we have 24-hour shelter check
okay
that we can check if there's space available so we can have them go to somewhere safe.
Mm-hmm. We're also able to provide immediate crisis intervention in the case that shelter's not available by putting folks in other safe locations mm-hmm. and providing transportation in emergency situations. We can't go into the emergency situation because we're not qualified for that,
mm-hmm.
but we are able to help coordinate immediate fleeing, I guess, for lack mm-hmm. of a better term, mm-hmm. for individuals and their families who need to leave immediately if the abuser is not present.
And so, if you were to encourage someone to call 911 because their situation is to that point, what are some of their reactions? I'm just thinking about people who might not be able to, be sure that they will be understood because maybe there's a language barrier, or maybe there's also the fear of, papers being asked for.
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen?
Yes, it happened, and we can definitely have a conversation. It happens that the survivor, as a matter of fact, I think we got a call recently that the survivor was calling when the abuser was in the house, and mm-hmm. we were listening to him screaming and yelling at the survivor. So the first thing that we asked was, are you safe? Can you speak right now? Is it safe to have a conversation? So she was like pretending that she was speaking with someone else.
Right.
So we asked, do you want us to call 911? And she said, yes. Do you want to do it or you want us to do it? She said, no, you do it. And he was screaming. We can hear him screaming, the children screaming and yelling. And she had time to give us the address, and we called 911 for her.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do like a follow-up if it's safe for the person.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And we certainly have had situations where folks did not feel safe calling the police for mm-hmm. fear of deportation
mm-hmm.
or other fears.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really unfortunate reality that there's mm-hmm. a reason that fear exists, and it's mm-hmm. completely valid. And we try to let folks know, like, you have the right to be safe, and you can't be deported for trying to be safe. Now, we can't make any guarantees ever, but we are able to say that. And often folks don't want their abuser deported. And that's something that folks don't have a hard time understanding when they're like, well, why doesn't she just want him gone? Why doesn't she just... That's her partner. That's somebody that she loves. And even though the abuse is there, that doesn't mean that she's able to just turn that off or that she wants him to be deported. And often we see folks who are judgmental of that with survivors instead of understanding that anything a survivor does is her choice. And we support whatever choice she makes, even if we don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. It's not our place to say, you should do this or you shouldn't do this. Our place is to say, what can we do to help you be safe? Mm-hmm. And that's the role that we play. So if someone says, no, don't call 911, I feel afraid that something will happen if the police come or if we're deported, then we have to respect that choice as well. As difficult as that is sometimes, like Shayla's saying, sometimes we get terrifying calls, but we have to, we're survivor driven. So the survivor is the one who makes the decisions.
Mm-hmm. So are these fears real that an abuser could be deported for, you know, being arrested, etc.? And how about the survivor themselves?
They are absolutely real. I mean, folks can certainly be deported if they're detained in a domestic violence arrest. I have never heard of a survivor being deported for reporting domestic violence. But to be completely honest, there have been folks who have been, if they're involved in other legal issues, then that might bring out those legal issues. That's extremely rare. I don't think that that should ever deter someone from calling if that's a safety issue ever. But I mean, yeah, I mean, it is possible for sure that that can happen.
But definitely the fear is real.
Absolutely.
What do you feel are some of the things that, what are some of the things that you say whenever people call and they say, no, I don't want the police involved because of those fears? Because you say that you are able to say, you know, well, if this is, if you are really in this, you know, safety situation, you should still call the police and you will not be deported for this reason. But as you say, you cannot make any guarantees.
No, and usually when we get that type of calls that they're worried that something like that happens, usually doesn't happen with the abuser present. I mean, not in my experience. When they're worried that something like that could happen, they are calling by themselves and, you know, we can have a conversation. But it's still sometimes they don't even want to report the abuse because the abuser has been brainwashing them and telling them, you know, they're not going to believe you. I'm going to take the kids away from you and I'm going to go back to my country and, you know, I'm going to take them with you and you're not ever going to see them again. So that's,
And that's a really hard one. And when those kinds of situations come about, we can let them know, you know, if you don't call the police, we can still help you to be safe. So still sending people to safe places. We will always offer people, you know, what we can. And we actually have two advocates who are stationed at a police station who work to provide culturally specific and linguistically specific services inside of the police station. And they bring the domestic violence perspective to the police station. So we deal with domestic violence in a very different way. And so that can help to alleviate some of that tension and some of that historic distrust, because if they have an advocate who comes with a police officer who's from El Programa Hispano, they say, okay, I know El Programa Hispano, I'll talk to you. And our advocate can speak to them in their own language. Our advocates are bicultural. And so that can help to kind of bridge some of these trust gaps that can then help the person to look for other safety options if that's what they want to do.
And sometimes it's not even safe to make a report. And that's another thing that we always tell them. We do not know that person as well as you do. So you know what's safer for you. Because it can be really dangerous to make a police report for the survivor. So
Has it been difficult to be able to have these advocates at police station? Or was it something that, that you know, the police was very open to have?
That's a really good question. Neither of us were there when that project started. So I can't say how, you know, that was initiated. I will say that there's certainly, I would say that there's some I don't know if difficulty is the right word, but that's one I'll use, at times because of the differences in professional cultures. Mm. So that's something that we have to work a lot on to make sure that those relationships stay positive. But I will say that the relationship has been overwhelmingly positive because, again, we can't do certain things, and we work with individuals who are in life-threatening situations and mm-hmm. extremely high lethality situations sometimes where we don't have the luxury of saying, well, we can't call the police. You know, this isn't exactly how we want it done. Sometimes we have to have them, involved. I don't know. Am I saying that right? But overwhelmingly, the relationship is very, very positive. But it is a challenge to try to figure out each other's professional cultures. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have advocates at the police station 24/7, or is it only...
They're there during...
During the day.
During the day, but there is the Proyecto Única. Advocates are there during the day, but other domestic violence agencies have some who are there also overnight.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're listening to Bread and Roses, and I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We're going to take a short musical break. I'm here in the studio with Kat Kelly and Chelo Ramirez, and they're both from Catholic Charities, Project Unica. And we've been talking about domestic violence and how it affects the Latino community here in the Portland area. We are going to go to a song, and we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Mira, escucha con confianza. Atenta a la población, ya está sonando la nueva alianza. Dignidad y sabiduría, allí en la enseñanza. Es su majestad imperial el que me cuida y no descansa. Quiero que te quede claro que cuando hablo de Babilón, refiero algo concreto, no es metáfora, atención. Son los muchos y distintos mecanismos de control que mantienen a la gente oprimida y en dolor. Como el racismo, imperialismo, capitalismo, colonialismo, fascismo, jerarquías y una gran cuota de egoísmo. Para la villa, para la población, favelas ante giles, no falta educación. Canto para la villa, para la población, la barriada, el rancherío, nos falta organización. No somos rebeldes, somos revolucionarios. No crees lo que dice la Biblia, pero lees los diarios. No sirven los políticos, nunca nos representaron. Esto no es justicia, no es realidad que está explotando. Un ejército despierta, alerta, una fuente de poder contra el tirano se manifiesta. Un ejército despierta, alerta, una fuente de poder contra el tirano se manifiesta. Vine para reedificar y tu visión del mundo reconsiderar. Vine para reedificar y tu visión del mundo reconsiderar. Como una leona, como una campeona, defiendo a mi pueblo que le han quitado la corona. Fuego no perdona, mi fe no me abandona. Discurso simple y a los ricachones incomoda. Los barrios se despiertan, el fuego llegó caliente. Somos nuevas semillas, nacimos independientes. Poder para la gente, no estés indiferente. Un pueblo con hambre está enojado y eso se siente. Un ejército despierta, alerta, una fuente de poder contra el tirano se manifiesta. Un ejército despierta, alerta, una fuente de poder contra el tirano se manifiesta. Canto para la villa, para la población, favelas, canteriles, nos falta educación. Canto para la villa, para la población, barriada, rancherío, nos falta organización. Un ejército despierta, alerta, una fuente de poder contra el tirano se manifiesta.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We just finished listening to, I'm going to butcher this, but I'm going to own it. Ederico Desperita is the name of the song. Alica e Nueva Alianza are the singers. I'm here in the studio with Kat Kelly and Chelo Ramirez, and they're both working with Project Unica, which is a project out of Catholic Charities. Right before the break, we were talking about the importance of having Spanish-speaking advocates in police stations when calls arise and people want to be able to report. Would you talk a little bit more about why is it so important that maybe a survivor is approached by one of your advocates instead of maybe a police officer?
Our advocates are specialists in in dealing with domestic violence situations, and they're also specialists in being able to provide services that try to minimize re-traumatization for survivors. And the police are not trained the same way, and oftentimes will not view domestic violence the same way that we view domestic violence, so, or sexual assault as well. So when one of our advocates goes with a police officer, she can bring this perspective that it's always going to be re-traumatizing to tell someone about what happened, but she can do it in a way that's very skilled and that minimizes that re-traumatization, that respects what the client wants to do. Frequently, clients will feel pressured by police to do something that maybe they don't feel is their first choice or feel empowered to do or say. And our advocate, being able to speak the language, can talk directly to the client, to the survivor. We've had the unfortunate reality of police officers using family members for interpretation after a domestic violence assault or a sexual assault, so children interpreting for parents who have been assaulted, which, as you can imagine, is enormously, enormously traumatizing for all family members and can create feelings of shame for the parents and switches the family roles around in a way that can cause irreparable damage in some way, in some cases. Or we'll go through an interpretation service, which are good if that's your last resort. It's better than having to give hand gestures and things like that. But frequently, you don't know the quality of interpretation you're getting. It's usually over the phone. So it can be really spotty connections. You can have folks from, you know, you might have a survivor from Oaxaca, Mexico, who has a interpreter from Argentina who can't understand each other because of the accents. And so that can be, you know, this really complex thing. And it's extremely complex. So having a person who's familiar with your culture, who's familiar with your language, and who most importantly knows about trauma is ideal. And so sending folks out with the police in that case has been, in my opinion, Shayla, maybe you can chime in about what you think, but has been enormously helpful.
Yes, and I agree with you.
Well, there's also, you have some Spanish support groups, so that would be for survivors who maybe are outside now or in a safe place. I'd love if you can talk a little bit about you know, why it's important also for these support groups to happen and to be available again in Spanish language.
Yeah. I think I can talk about that. the support, we have like four support groups already. One in Portland, one in Gresham, one DV orientation that survivors can go for like 3 hours and a half, once a month before they start participating in the support groups. But support groups are very important because it's a safe place for the survivor to speak up and have someone that has been going through similar experiences. We are not the facilitators. We are not teachers, and you know, we're not there to try to teach them a lesson, but just to facilitate and, you know, bring information, how to recognize red flags and, you know, how to overcome things that they can do to feel much better. And, you know, we bring resources and information about domestic violence and sexual assault.
And so who are the people who answer your crisis line or people who help facilitate these support groups? Are they volunteer? Are they paid staff? Who are they?
We have volunteers that answer the crisis line and also us, the advocates and program manager, assistant manager, all the advocates. So
We're pretty grassroots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yes. So no matter what your position is within the organization, you'll have some time on the front line.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the crisis line is the most important service that we offer because it gets folks to us. So we all are there. Mm-hmm. And Sheila does an amazing job.
And that's how. Thank you. So, and then we get to refer them to the right programs for them to receive services.
But you do rely someone on volunteers, right?
Yes. We have wonderful volunteers.
Wonderful volunteers.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering.
Plus, I don't want to leave out the night fox. They do an amazing job. Yes. The on-call people who answer the phone at nighttime.
Yeah. Mm.
So and over the weekends.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. I was going to ask you, so how many calls do you get, like in a day or in a night? I don't know, in a 24-hour period. And how many people do you have always on call? Is there just one person? Is there more?
So it varies, but this last trimester we got over 450 domestic violence and sexual assault calls, and over 150 information and referral calls. DV calls and stalking and sexual assault, not too many, but crisis calls are the most that we get. Last month we received, I believe, like almost 200 crisis call.
It really varies.
And it varies every day.
Every day. And according to the season, domestic violence changes with the season, unfortunately. So we'll see an increase in incidences in the summer. And we see a decrease around the holidays. And then another increase right after the holidays. So it really, you know, and some days, Mondays tend to be more busy because we've been, folks assume that we're closed sometimes, but we actually are staffed, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So in the evenings, we have one person who's answering the line, and we have one backup person. And then our management team, our leadership team is available in case of emergencies as well. So there's three layers to make sure that the line is always staffed.
Wow. I just want to say thank you to volunteers and staff who, you know, spend, you know, are on call even at night and during the weekend. So important.
You're pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you also have a public education program where, you know, you offer presentations in Spanish and in English about domestic violence, sexual assault, and how they affect the Latino community. If you could talk a little bit about where do you usually give this these presentations, how would people go about attending one or inviting you to maybe the organization?
I can talk a little bit to that. So we have a couple of different approaches to discussing domestic and sexual violence with the community. Our approach that's around education about domestic violence that's aimed at community adults, I would say. We do that in schools and in the Mexican consulate and in other social service agencies, as well as community events like health fairs and going on the radio or the television, things like that. And then we also have a culturally specific sexual assault prevention program, which is really great. We're the only culturally specific prevention program in the state right now. And so that's run, it's called PAS, Prevención de Asalto Sexual, which means prevention of sexual violence. And so we go into schools, and our prevention advocate, I think, worked with 400 youth last year. And so they do a lot of education around consent, around bystander intervention, around addressing oppression and things that lead to oppressive actions and those kinds of things. And she works with middle schoolers and high schoolers. And that's one of our favorite programs. We love prevention. So that's really great. And can you think of other education stuff I'm doing?
We do tutoring.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have a couple of advocates that go to the houses of the survivors, and they do tutoring for them. And I think we have a client that in less than 6 months, she learned how to write, how to read with zero knowledge of writing and reading. She is already writing, reading, and she's writing her first book.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, once you get the skills, you have a lot to say.
Yeah.
why are these programs so important? Why do you do prevention? Why do you do education to the community?
Well, prevention is just so essential. It's ridiculously underfunded. But it's prevention is what keeps domestic violence and sexual assault from happening, especially in the context of sexual assault and young people. When we talk about concepts of consent and things like that, frequently young people aren't taught that consent is okay, that consent is something that needs to happen, whether that's in a friendship context or you know, a romantic relationship, a marriage, whatever that case may be. And so learning how to consent and learning how to respect consent is the fundamentals of having healthy relationships. Mm-hmm. And so that can deter, if that's the right word, you know, future violence, because you know that there's such a thing as, unfortunately, unintentional violence for young people and older people as well, who don't understand how to respect what somebody says or what somebody wants. And teaching people how to respect that and how to understand consent is a key part to eliminating, you know, certain forms of violence. Not all, for sure, but it definitely contributes to making relationships healthier and all of those things.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why also I wanted you guys to come on tonight to Brad and Rose's, because I feel the education part is so important. Very often, I mean, there's so much that you guys have shared already that I just was not aware of. You know, there's, as you said earlier, sometimes people are not able to understand why a survivor would decide to not report and have her spouse or her partner deported, and how, you know, it's difficult for folks to really be able to grasp that. But unless you educate yourself, unless you listen to what people who are faced by those kinds of challenges have to say.
Can I add something to that? Please. Real quick? When we were talking about that, I think it's important for folks to know that it on average takes a survivor 7 times to leave a partner. And the major reason that people go back is for economic reasons, because folks, the barriers are so enormous and the resources are so few that you have no choice but to go back. And I think that that's really misunderstood.
Yeah.
There needs to be a lot more compassion and understanding around the fact that, you know, the domestic violence continuum of services in Multnomah County receives 2% of the county budget. There's no resources. So when someone comes to us and needs housing and we say our housing program's full, what is she supposed to do with her children? She has to go back. And it's important to approach that from a non-judgmental place and say, you know, this is not, it's part of victim blaming to say, like, why is she going back? You know, mm-hmm. that's victim blaming, and we need to eliminate that kind of thinking when it comes to working with survivors.
And it happens very often, the victim blaming, because the survivor went back with the abuser, mm-hmm. due to the lack of resources.
Mm-hmm. It's violence from the system. Yeah. You know, she's experiencing violence in the home and then violence from the system, and she's being blamed for both. We need to be really aware of what that does to a survivor and what that does to families.
Thank you for that. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We're going to take a short musical break. I'm here with Kat Kelly and Shella Ramirez, both from Project Unica of Catholic Charities, and we've been talking about how domestic violence and sexual abuse are impacting the Latino community here in the Portland area. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Sentido si lo creamos los dos, liberarse de todo el pudor, tomar de las riendas, no rendirse al opresor, caminar erguido sin temor, respirar y sacar la voz. Tengo
los bolsillos vacíos, los labios partidos, la piel con escama cada vez que miro hacia el vacío, las suelas gastadas, las manos atadas, la puerta de entrada siempre tuvo el cartel que dijo que estaba cerrada, una espina clavada, una herida infectada, entramada, una rabia colmada en el todo y en la nada, el paso torpe al borde sin acorde, cada vez que pierdo el norte, tengo la pérdida del soporte, el tiempo que clava, me traba, la daga me mata, filuda la flama sin calma, que de las manos se me escapa, pero tengo mi rincón florido, sacar la voz, no estoy sola, estoy conmigo.
Liberarse de todo el pudor, tomar de las riendas, no rendirse al opresor, caminar erguido sin temor, respirar y sacar la voz.
Cayeron todos los fragmentos que estaban quebrados, el mirar encorvado, el puño cerrado. No tengo nada, pero nada.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We just finished listening to Anna Tijoux, Saca la Voz. And I'm here in the studio with Kat Kelly and Shella Ramirez from Project Unica. And before the break, we were talking about some of the programming that they are doing for educational and prevention, etc. I thought that we could give the number out for the crisis line before we move on.
Yes, and that number is 503-232-4448 or 1-888-232-4448.
Thank you so much. I think it's very important that we have this out. I wanted to talk a little bit about also the support that you offer with race training and stalking orders and with actually the process of getting that. Can you talk a little bit about what the program is about and why it's important that you help and assist with that process?
Well, we have an advocate that works, it's outstationed at the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence, and she works for the Latino communities and help them fill out the restraining order. Mm-hmm. Stalking orders are usually, you have to file them in the courthouse. You cannot do it at the Gateway Center. But what happens is that the client, the participant goes there, asks for someone who speaks Spanish, and mm-hmm. it's a navigation, a navigator, what mm-hmm. we have there. And she will help the client navigate the system.
Yeah, how hard exactly. is the process?
It can be very hard for the survivor mm. to start telling the story. Everything is going to be written in paper. Mm. So it can be very re-traumatizing mm. for them. And we always give them the choice, you know, sometimes it's not safe for them to do it. Mm. So they always have the choice to, yes, you want I want to do it or no.
So they have to somewhat prove that yes, there's a real yes. danger.
When they go there, they have to, you know, it's their decision. Sometimes once they get there, they start asking questions about the restraining order. Mm-hmm. So is he or her, whoever the abuser mm-hmm. is, going to read what I'm writing, that mm-hmm. I'm saying this? We always tell them, yes, everything, that person is going to get served with that pile of papers mm-hmm. so it's gonna see everything that you wrote, so they decide that no, that they don't want to do it, but they still want to, you know, to access all the resources that they have at the same center mm-hmm. for them.
And would you talk a little bit about the differences between restraining order versus stalking order?
Well, restraining order is something that you can file against an intimate partner or a member of the family. And it has to be blood
related
mm-hmm. or, you know, any member, legal mm-hmm. member of the family. Mm-hmm. And stalking is something that you can do for someone that it's stalking you. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to get one of those because those are for life. Mm. So, okay. yeah. That's why you have to go to the courthouse, and I think you go to 2 or 3 hearings before it gets finalized, approved, by the judge.
I wanted to thank you for that information. I think it's, you know, if you don't need one, you're not really aware of the process, you know. But I wanted to talk a little bit also about, you know, you say that Project Unica works to ensure that the Latino individuals and families have equal access to community resources. I was wondering how you're able to do that, and what are some of the things that are still lacking, some of the things that maybe the rest of the community is able to access, but because of some barriers the Latino community is struggling with. Obviously, you have the crisis line, you have the support groups, etc.
Well, we could have a whole hour just to talk about that, for sure.
And I will say the language, shelter, it's always a huge problem. Mm-hmm. I will say that a huge barrier for the, not the shelter, but not having the space available for the survivor. Mm-hmm. And not being able to screen a survivor to get into shelter because they do not have an advocate or someone who speaks Spanish. That's a huge one, I would say.
Yeah, shelter is extremely, it's a really finite resource. The shelters that we have here are wonderful, but we have 33 crisis beds for Multnomah County. That's really not much at all. And so that's a huge barrier. And then we have the added barrier oftentimes of folks who documentation status can provide, can create huge barriers to housing, access to housing, access to emergency food services, access to mental health services, just this array of services that are available to other folks. And I think actually I like that we have the word equal in there, but we've really started to kind of move more towards the word equitable, because we know that if the Latino community gets equal amount of dollars as other communities, that still isn't equitable because the barriers are larger. So we need more resources because since the barriers are larger, we need more resources in order to help support clients to be stable. We were doing a case analysis just today, actually, and when we finished, we saw that in order to stabilize this client and her family, we worked with 10 different agencies, with us as the primary advocacy agency, but 10 agencies to make sure that this family was as stable as possible, and that included getting housing. That included getting access to mental health services, food services, support groups, you know, all of these things. You're not going to need 10 agencies for a family who doesn't have those kind of barriers. So being aware that equal services are not equitable services is really important. A dollar does not stretch the same for a Latino family as it does for an English language white family.
Mm-hmm. So I think we need more money.
We need more money.
Well, also, it sounds to me like you're also trying to fill in some gaps that are being created by some institutionalized discrimination and lack of being able to access resources for all. I think that, are you able to do some advocacy at all, or is it, you know, are you trying to just focus on the services that you can offer, or are you also trying to, with the project, work with the city or work with the county, et cetera, to make sure that there is that awareness that there are different barriers for the Latino community?
Yeah, we get to do a lot of advocacy, which is wonderful. And we have great community partners who know the importance of having to have a culturally and linguistically specific model. So that's why we have someone at the Gateway Center who, you know, the Gateway Center prioritizes having those kinds of services. They know how important that is. We have a partner in Gresham DHS, you know, who's able to keep one of our advocates there. We have partners in Clackamas County in the rural areas, things like that. So that advocacy that started before, you know, probably 5-10 years ago, has now made it so that we are more present and there's more points of entry for Latina clients and Latino survivors of violence. So that's certainly worked. And then, you know, just last week we were present at all the county, you know, budget hearings and all of these things to say domestic violence is an issue. We need more support. We need more awareness around this issue. It's enormous. And if you mix domestic violence with racism, you have a really toxic combination. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to make folks aware of.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to speak a little bit about, you guys are organizing a conference coming up, Voices de la Comunidad, Supporting Latina Survivors. That's going to be in July 24th and 25th, but registration is already open. So I wanted, I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about that. What is the conference going to be about? And who are you inviting to attend and to register for it?
Well, we are inviting everybody. Mm-hmm. So we want doctors, social workers, everybody.
Community members, everything.
Everything. So we want everybody to come and join us. We're going to do something great for the whole community, and we're going to have presentations, activities.
Yeah, we really wanted to. So the conference has two separate tracks. Mm-hmm. One is the English language track that's aimed towards English language professionals and community members and advocates, et cetera, who want to improve their practice with the Latino community. So understanding these barriers and how to address them, understanding how racism and xenophobia and all of the other forms of oppression that Latino community members face, understanding how that affects access to services. And then the second track is a Spanish language track that's designed to provide content courses in Spanish to social workers and advocates in order to help, you know, round out our practice because we often don't have access to high-level trainings in Spanish. Usually what happens is you get, you know, domestic violence 101 or you get oppression 101 and those kinds of things, which are wonderful, but we really need more intensive, more we need deeper education around the things that we work with every day. So we are going to have a workshop on neurobiology and trauma in Spanish, a workshop on facilitating and interrupting oppressive behavior in Spanish. We're going to be having another workshop on navigating the legal system in Spanish, these kinds of things so that advocates can feel more empowered around their practice because we work in Spanish, and so we should have training in Spanish as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so people who work with the Latino community might want to be getting access to some of this very important training.
Absolutely. And yeah, Latino advocates, Latina advocates, allies, everybody's welcome.
Welcome.
It's going to be great.
Welcome.
So again, this is July 24th and 25th. And I wanted to end by asking you a little bit about some of the volunteer opportunities that you might have if you wanted to bring a call out to volunteers. Do they need to be bilingual or do you also accept Spanish speakers only? And how would they get in contact with you?
Yeah, we can definitely take volunteers from all over the place. But yes, they need to be bilingual. Okay. They need to speak Spanish and English so we can communicate. And
You have to do a lot of advocacy with multiple community partners. So
yeah,
If there are folks who are monolingual Spanish, we do find a role for you that's easier than someone who's monolingual English. Yeah. So you must be at least bilingual Spanish, English, or speak Spanish. You can't be monolingual English, unfortunately.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm about to share a link to your website, but I was wondering if you can also share again the crisis line number.
Yes, Shayla. Of course. And the crisis line number is 503-232-4448 or 1-888-232-4448.
Thank you so much. So to find out more about Project Unica, you can go to... the website is www.catholiccharitiesoregon.org/latino_services_unica.asp. Again, it's catholiccharitiesoregon.org/latino_services_unica.asp. Thank you so much to both of you
Thank
for
you.
Spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having us.
Very enlightening. And thank you all for tuning in to Bread and Roses. We are a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs every Friday. Make sure to tune in next Friday. You can find us on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses, and also on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. Have a wonderful week, everyone, and we're going to leave you with Sueños Rotos, Boca Flora, and Akil Amar. Have a wonderful evening.
The women are being killed in the same fashion. They're being raped, they're being strangled, and dumped out in the middle of a desert on the side of a road behind the state police, like ultra headquarters, located in Chihuahua City.
Frontera que no le hace honor al benemérito. Presente y no pasado, copretérito, calor desértico. No hay verde, no hay historia que por lógica concuerde. Es el vaivén del hambre que cruza diariamente aquel alambre. Tan solo tiene 15, larga jornada laboral por ella espera. El transporte público hace esquina en la siguiente acera, cosiendo y cosiendo miles de prendas de manera sistemática. No tiene tiempo de juegos, es su dinámica. Cada centavo del minúsculo salario tiene dueño. Prohibido terminantemente el mínimo gesto de sueño. La escuela no está dentro de sus planes. Primero a resolver necesidades primordiales. Mismas pisadas a la izquierda, 3 metros y después derecha. Sigue la misma ruta donde el lobo acecha. Y así aprendió a vivir con el temor como algo sano. Su amigo miedo, el compañero cotidiano. Y ahora que pasa en la radio narrando un nuevo hallazgo. La sociedad vomita de asco. 300 muertas y no hay rastro. Óyeme bien, 300.
We are at the end of Bread and Roses right now. We're getting into Hard Knock, news, views, and hip hop. It is 6:59 right now. And we are. Excuse me, I apologize. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I was distracted by the awesome sunshine that's outside and some craziness that's happening, but you are tuned in to KBOO. You can donate at any time by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the tip jar and giving as much information as you want. Thank you.
Sueños rotos, adiós a la inocencia, existencia arrebatada. Después de caminar por el viejo sendero, pero a la hora equivocada, solo culpable fue de no saber lo que pasaba con un simple porqué.
Native American Business Network is holding its 12th annual Trading at the River Conference and Native Marketplace at Lewis and Clark College, May 27th through the 29th. ONABEN is a nonprofit public benefit corporation created by Northwest Tribes to increase the success of private businesses owned by Native Americans. Trading at the River features inspirational speakers, informative panels, and valuable workshops for small business owners and economic development organizations. ONABEN also welcomes community members to come check out the Native Marketplace, a highlight of the event, which features over 20 Native vendors. It is open to the public from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., May 29th at Lewis and Clark College at Smith Hall. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found on kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.